From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. To be stoical, in modern usage, indicates indifference to pleasure or pain, to be unaffected by passion or feeling. But what did Stoicism mean to its Greek adherents in the 4th century before Christ, when it originated? How does Stoicism reach subsequent periods in history, especially as it connects with Christianity and the modern mind? Seeking answers to those questions, one scholar at the National Humanities Center has recently completed a book about the transmission, influences, and uses of Stoicism. She is Marcia Kolisch, and she teaches history at Oberlin College in Ohio.
Actually, in antiquity, Stoicism was much more than an ethical philosophy. It was a physics, a logic, as well as an ethics. And the ancient Stoics, who began with Zeno and who were called Stoics because they taught in a painted porch, or stoa, in what is now the Athenian Forum, is actually a railroad overpass that is located directly above the location of the stoa, which has generated some controversies between archaeologists who wanted to dig it up and the Greek government. But they had their own relationship among the three subdivisions of philosophy, and they used a number of metaphors to try to describe them. One was that philosophy was a walled garden. Logic was the wall, demarcating the limits. Physics was the tree, the structure of reality, and ethics was the fruit. You can see that ethics is the most important, but it's dependent on the other two. But another image that the Stoics used to make the same point about the relationship among logic, physics, and ethics was to describe philosophy as an egg, in which logic is the shell, physics is the white, and ethics is the yolk. And actually, you could begin a study of this philosophy at any point, whether from logic, physics, or ethics, because they are all organically interrelated.
Marcia, you say that Stoicism comes to us fragmented, comes to us indirectly. How is it possible to understand what it's all about, if this is in fact the case?
Well, it is in fact the case, and you began by noting that the school was founded in the 4th century BC. The earliest teachers in the school, Zeno, Cleanthes, and Chrysippus, wrote tremendous amounts of treatises, none of which has come down to us, and what has been collected are what they thought as reported by other people, which has all been edited, fortunately, by a learned German scholar around the turn of the century. And then there's another wave of Stoics who lived in the 2nd century, who were called the Middle Stoa, Panaetius and Posidonius, and none of their works have come down in entirety either, and they have been collected. Again, fragments often reported by hostile witnesses or doxographers who weren't really interested in exploring their implications.
What is a doxographer?
Well, a doxographer would be a person whose chief contribution he felt was simply to list what other people said. Doxa means opinion or doctrine. That's where we get the word doctrine from. And you do get a number of figures in antiquity in the late Hellenistic period, Diogenes Laertius, Sextus Empiricus, who do this. They run through the philosophical schools and tell you little bio-bibliographical bits of information about them, who the philosophers were, what their lives were, what they wrote, and what their opinions were. They may or may not seek to criticize them.
So what you're doing is listening to echoes.
You're listening to echoes.
And trying to figure out what's reliable in those echoes.
And that is one of the major problems.
Sounds like a very risky thing to do.
I think this is one of the main reasons why no one had ever done this study until I got involved. Because typically the sorts of scholars who were interested in studying the influence of Greek philosophy work from a philological method, where they can trace parallel texts being used by successive authors, see whether they're being quoted exactly, whether these testimonies of antiquity are being accurately preserved.
In other words, they're working literally by the book.
By the book.
They have concrete evidence there.
And they're also working by the manuscript. They are working from a chain of manuscript witnesses, which they then try to arrange in a genealogical table to try to ascertain what the correct reading is, so that they can reconstruct not only how the tradition has come down through the manuscript, but what the correct doctrine is at its earliest manifestation.
Marcia, how does that differ from what you're doing?
Well, because we're dealing with not what the Stoics said themselves, but with other people's opinions of their views, you cannot simply go by the book with a philological parallelism of text, because you're not getting the words themselves as they were first written. You're just having to rely on the sense of the words, not a kind of textual parallelism.
And this calls into question your own judgment.
It calls into question your judgment.
It's a critical activity.
It's a very critical activity, and there are debates among the experts as to how to interpret these fragments, uh-huh. some of which will probably never be resolved because there are simply gaps in the information. And you have to be very careful about trying to fill them yourself with ideas that you extrapolate from the material to try to make the thing more three-dimensional than it ever can be. Mm-hmm. There are just points, I think, where you have to say, all right, this is an interesting question that flows from the questions we've just looked at, but we don't know what they said on this point.
Well, given all of that, what is the Stoic tradition, and what specifically is your interest in it?
Well, I think, for one thing, we have to recognize that what we can know about it in antiquity is limited. The only Stoics who wrote in extenso were Roman Stoics. They wrote mostly in Greek, except for Seneca, and they were the least interested in the logic and the physics. And this is one of the reasons why Stoicism in popular imagination has come down to us as a primarily ethical philosophy.
A way of behaving.
Right, because yeah. the Romans were primarily interested in this dimension. Mm-hmm. And also the Stoic thinkers in Rome were not professors in a school. They were not heads of the school with the obligation of teaching and defending the doctrine. They were simply people who were drawing on this philosophy because they were attracted to it. They thought it was a wisdom that could help. But they were really interested in it primarily for its applicability to the good life as they understood it. So this is mainly what is picked up of Stoicism by the Latin authors in antiquity. And I think what's interesting from my standpoint is that as you move from the pagan authors who wrote in Latin, and you can find them up through the 6th century AD, into the Christian Latin authors of the same period, and I should add here that I'm interested in tracing the Latin tradition rather than the Greek, the Christian authors are often much more broad-gauged in the aspects of Stoicism that they're interested in. They are much less preclusively ethical than is true for their pagan counterparts, and I think there are two main reasons for this. In the first place, a lot of them are theologians who are charged by their place in the church as prelates, as teachers, with formulating Christian doctrine and defending it against both paganism and various heresies. And they found in Stoic logic and Stoic physics often principles and ideas that were useful for theological and exegetical and polemical purposes. And secondly, you do find among the Christian writers in this period, up through the 6th century, some men of genuinely speculative mind. And I think the two who are at the top of the list are St. Augustine, who was the only person in this period, Christian or pagan, to develop a vast philosophy of history, a vast psychology, a vast conception of how the world was created. He really was interested in the big questions, capital B, capital Q, not just the ad hoc issues that he needed to resolve in order to...
Well, what are the lineaments of Stoicism? What would a... Is it possible simply to summarize what a Stoic would believe, the main principles?
One could certainly do it. I think, first of all, in physics, the most central doctrine is monism. The Stoics were opposed to the idea, which you get in Plato and Aristotle, that reality can be subdivided into matter and spirit. They believe reality was one big thing. It was sort of like a coin. You could look at it from the obverse or the reverse side and call these two sides matter and spirit, but they're simply two perspectives on one unitary mm-hmm. phenomenon.
Plato, on the other hand, would say that there is a world of ideas
exactly.
beyond what we experience daily.
And also that it's more important.
Mm-hmm.
Aristotle tried to put the ideas in the things, but his concept of things is still a composite made up of matter and form into substances, which have these two components. But they can be abstracted out of the two components. And that's what happens, for example, when we form an idea about a physical thing. But for the Stoics, it's all one thing. And they have been cast and castigated as materialists, which is true. One of their lines in this connection is that everything that acts is a body. So that entities, for example, like the human soul or like the deity, which would be regarded as immaterial in other traditions, they see as bodies.
Do they believe in a God?
Yes, they do, and God for them is identical with the universe. He is the law of nature. There's no distinction between the universal system and God himself, rather than seeing a creator who is different from the world he creates. And they also believe that the mind of man was made up of the same substance as God. so that every man has a spark of the divine, literally, in his own being. And this is a material component. They believe that there were four elements. This is a typical Greek belief: earth, air, fire, and water, and that God and the soul were made up of the most rarefied of the elements, fire and air, in a kind of ethereal compound.
Where does this lead the Stoics in terms of the way they live their lives?
Well, I think the most important implication of this concept of the universe is that there is a natural law which is identical with the order of nature physically, and which is also identical with the moral order. And it is identified both as matter and as reason. The divine reason and human reason are the same thing. And for the wise man, he has to know the order of the universe, and he has to recognize it as the law of his own being. And for this reason, the physics informs the ethics. Virtue for the Stoics is life in accordance with nature, or life in accordance with reason, which is the same thing.
You could be talking about Henry David Thoreau or Ralph Waldo Emerson. I meant to ask you parenthetically, mm-hmm. if Stoicism persists. My guess is that it does.
Well, there is a very important carryover beyond the periods I've been studying, in particular in the Enlightenment, in which the cosmopolitanism and naturalism and rationalism of Stoicism exercised a very wide appeal. I think the main difference that you see in the Enlightenment versions of Stoicism as compared, let's say, with Renaissance or medieval, is that the medieval and Renaissance authors did not really see a fundamental disharmony between Stoicism and Christianity. There were some points that were criticized by Christians. For example, they could not accept the principle that God is physical, or that God is identical with man or with nature. But they basically saw the two as compatible. Whereas in the Enlightenment, you find many of the philosophers who were extremely atheistic and who wanted to attack established churches as the supports of the established monarchical order, using classical philosophy like Stoicism as a weapon against Christian revelation.
Well, here you've introduced a political element.
It's not only political, it's ideological, because you find this type of criticism in a variety of different political settings. It's most acute in France, where you have an established order, where you have divine right monarchy that is connected with an established church that owns most of the property in the country. It's much less acute in countries like Britain, where there's a parliamentary system and there are ways of changing things without revolution. And you don't get this element very strongly noticed in German Enlightenment thought. So it depends a lot on the environment. But I think you do get the sense that Stoicism could provide the foundation for a secular philosophy, secular in the sense that there is nothing beyond this world, and God himself is equated with the world, and a validation of a naturalistic, rationalistic ethic for man without any appeal to revelation or transcendental ideals beyond what can develop from one's own reason.
Marcia, let's move backward in time. What specifically are you doing with it?
What I'm specifically doing is tracing the fortunes of Stoicism and the uses made of it by Latin thinkers, both in the classical period of pagan Rome and in the period of the church fathers and apologists, which extends up through the 6th century AD. As far as Latin literature is concerned, they begin essentially with the 1st century BC, with figures like Cicero and Horace, Virgil, and they extend up to the 6th century. Mm-hmm. And with the Christian writers, of course, you don't get any Christian writers until the Christian era begins. And the first of them is Tertullian, who lived in the late 2nd and 3rd century. And the last author I'm dealing with among the Christian writers is Martin of Braga, who is not a household word, so I better tell you a little bit about him.
Okay.
He was a French priest who went across the Pyrenees to try to convert the Germanic tribe, the Suevi, then living in northern Spain, from Arianism, a Christian heresy, to Orthodoxy. And he succeeded in this mission and was made a bishop eventually of Braga, which is now in Portugal. And he wrote a number of works that are very heavily based on Stoic ethics.
Let me give you
a couple of examples.
Sure.
Tertullian, who was the first of the Christian Latin writers, was working in a period when there were intense debates among theologians on the nature of Christ and the doctrine of the Trinity. This was in the period immediately before the major church council at Nicaea in the early 4th century that laid down the basic creed, which then became the foundation of Christian orthodoxy. But the fact that they had to call this conference was a function of the intense debates on these matters. And part of it was the problem that people were coming to this as Christians with philosophically trained minds and trying to find terms.
They were asking questions like, does God have a body?
Well, that was one problem.
That kind of thing.
But I think even more critical is the whole question of the nature of Christ. Mm-hmm. In Christian terms, you have a being here who is supposed to be holy God and holy man. He adds up to 200%, and it has to be a zero-sum game if you come at this from classical mathematics.
So what did they say?
Well, Tertullian believed that both the body of man was corporeal and the soul. And he also believed with the Stoics that God was corporeal, though of a very rarefied material substance. And the Stoics had developed a conception of how elements mix, which is unique to them. There are various ways of dealing with this problem in ancient physics, but they believed, and this is very non-Euclidean, and I think it's an absolutely delightful idea, that two physical elements could occupy the same space at the same time without changing, each retaining its own characteristics and not turning into some new compound or mixture or some third thing. You really have three ingredients here. You have a divine nature, which is corporeal, and you have a human nature, which has both a spiritual and a physical component, both of which are corporeal, though the spirit is more rarefied than the body. And these can all come together, each retaining its own nature, so that Christ is fully man while being fully God. He's not some amalgam, like a 50-50 split, which is one of the positions he was attacking. Well, Tertullian would be one case of a very creative application of a Stoic physical principle. Unfortunately, it was not very influential because later theologians rejected forcibly his conception of God as corporeal and the human soul as corporeal, and then confronted their own problems in trying to account for the nature of Christ. But this is one example of an application. Similarly, in the case of logic and semantics, the Stoics developed a distinction between words as corporeal forms, things that are produced by the vocal cords in a physical way, transmitted across the airways with one bunch of air bumping against another bunch of air until it gets to the human ear, resonating in the ear, a completely physical process. And then they also had a concept of words as concepts in the mind. Just as a philosopher might think of an idea or develop a logical formula, he might develop a syllogism whose terms made total sense in relation to each other that said absolutely nothing about the real world, and it would yet have a logical validity. You could talk in that sense about logical truth or logical predication or logical inference without making statements about the transferability of the conclusions to things outside the mind.
That sounds very Platonic.
It is in a way, except that for Plato, those are the only kinds of ideas you could have. Mm-hmm. The Stoics had this double conception, and this too could be and was applied to the problem of Christ's nature, specifically his relationship to God the Father, against heretics who wanted to argue that if Christ is begotten, as the creed says, he must be inferior to God the Father, since after all, human fathers have to be there first before they can produce sons, so thus Christ cannot have the same eternity as God the Father, and he must be inferior also because he's a combination of human and divine nature and not pure divinity. And it's against this line of argument that some theologians, Augustine is a very good example, though he has many Greek predecessors among Christian writers too, will use the Stoic logical distinction between the inner word, the intramental word, and the word as spoken outwardly to develop their own theory on this point. So they will argue, for example, that before the incarnation of Christ, Christ is the inner word of the Father, eternally engendered in the Father's mind. Just as you can ruminate an idea in your head, and it's exactly the same as what you think.
In other words, he's a principle.
Well, he's still a word. He's not a principle. He's still a person. But he is in no way distinct from the thinking Father, in a sense, in nature, in eternity, in substance, or in anything else. And then you have the word outwardly spoken, in which Christ assumes human visible form in the incarnation in order to make him available to mankind, perceptible to man. And this would be analogized to the spoken word. Mm-hmm. After you've thought up your ideas in your head, you can then express them outwardly. But the ideas in your head are still in your head. They're still in your mind, they're still in your memory, even though you make them accessible to other people by expressing them in physical form. So this would be another example of how a Stoic principle, in this case logic and semantics, is removed completely from its original context in their philosophy and applied to the solution of a Christian dogmatic problem of major importance to the theologians, primarily in a polemical vein to defend orthodoxy against what they feel are heterodox, erroneous understandings.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation with Marcia Kolisch, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of history at Oberlin College in Ohio. While at the National Humanities Center, Professor Kolisch completed a book about the Greek philosophy Stoicism and the ways in which Stoicism was transmitted through classical, early Christian, medieval, and modern periods of history. Marcia, let me just ask you to comment briefly. What kind of an audience did this stuff have?
I think the audience would be different depending on whether you're talking about the pagan writers or the Christian writers. The Christian writers were preachers and churchmen who were interested in popularizing the doctrines they were developing and defending. They were pastors interested in teaching their people and leading them in the right path. And in fact, a great deal of the literature we have from this period is in the form of sermons. Even the exegesis of the Bible is not done in a strictly scholarly, formal vein, but is done in the pulpit. And they're interested in having their ideas as disseminated as widely as possible, just because they are in that position as public leaders in the church who want to clarify doctrine and teach it to their people.
Well, what would the so-called pagan writers be doing with
it? The pagan writers are working in a variety of forms of literature, ranging from satiric poetry to history to epic poetry. And these are things that would probably be read only by the literate, upper-class, educated public. You don't have anything remotely similar to the preaching that would go on to the people in the pulpit in a Christian environment. It's true, of course, that some of the Christian writers, particularly in dealing with the most technical aspects of doctrine, would be writing primarily for other church leaders in a vein that would be a little bit difficult to understand for the average person. But there's a much more of an interest in translating what they have to say into an idiom that can be appropriated orally in public preaching.
Marcia, let me ask you to comment just a little further. What else can you say about the inheritance of Stoicism? How else does it pass itself along?
Well, I think there are two main stages beyond the period that I have studied where important additions to the knowledge of Stoicism in Western Europe were made. The first has been studied the least, and it would be in the 12th and 13th centuries when the material from Byzantium and medieval Islam was translated into Latin. And these two cultures had possessed Greek philosophy in its original language. It had been translated into Arabic by the Muslims and elaborated on in great detail. And we really know very little of how this was done. The study of this dimension of the Stoic tradition is still very much in its infancy, but my guess is that once these Greco-Arabic translations were made in the 12th and 13th centuries, a tremendous amount of information would be added to what the Western mind already had from the patristic and classical authors. My guess would be also that it would primarily affect the physics and the logic, since these were the areas that the Muslims were especially interested in. But until the scholars with the linguistic skills to study that chapter of the story have done it, it's going to be something of a question mark. The second major chapter is much better studied, and this is the Neo-Stoicism of the Renaissance, which is a function of the publication of the Greek texts. As I mentioned earlier, the Roman Stoics, who were the only ones with extended treatises, all wrote in Greek except for Seneca. So there was a tremendous mass of material in these authors, figures like Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, Musonius Rufus, and so forth, which could now be made available. There was enough of a Greek-speaking population in the Western world to read the Greek and to make translations of these materials for the first time into the Latin tongue. And here you find almost an immediate translation of these materials, not only from the Greek to the Latin, but into the vernacular. We know, for example, that Montaigne wrote his Pensée in the margins of his copy of Epictetus. And other thinkers in the same period were intensely interested. It really represented a new body of philosophical material that they hadn't really had at their disposal before. And aside just from the interest in this on the part of people who were classical scholars, they saw its immediate relevance to the problems that they were confronting in the 16th century world, which included, among other things, religious wars and theological disputes stemming from the Reformation. The theme of consolation, of rising above distress, was a very appealing one in a war-torn country like France, where a fratricidal civil religious war reigned for 30 years. And also people whose ideas had been pulled in so many different directions by all the different theological options of the period, sometimes had the tendency to fall into skepticism. And indeed, there was a neo-skeptic revival in the same period. And they found in some of the certitudes of Stoicism a kind of refreshing home base that they could use to reaffirm their belief in truth as possible.
How does Stoicism come to us in the 20th century in terms of the way people think and the way they behave? Is there a school of Stoicism anymore?
No, I wouldn't say that there was a school of Stoicism, really, after about the 16th century. But there have been some particular concerns of 20th century thinkers that have stimulated an interest in this topic. For one thing, a lot of the philosophers nowadays who are intensely interested in formal logic have gone back to Stoic logic, which they see in some respects as a forerunner of some of the concerns which they're currently interested in. And this has stimulated a great deal of effort on the part of logicians to incorporate the history of Stoicism into the history of logic more generally. Another theme which I think has been important, particularly in the periods immediately following the two world wars, is the theme of natural law. Now, I mentioned a while back that the Stoics believed in a natural law that was identified with God and with the human reason, and so they could construct a theory of natural law that not only accounted for the operations of the physical world, but was a moral norm for mankind. This notion first gets applied to jurisprudence and legal thinking in the strict sense in ancient Rome, largely thanks to the efforts of Cicero. And we find this in his political theory and his legal theory, his On the Republic and On the Laws, both of which survived in rather fragmentary form, unfortunately. But you do find another phase of interest in this whole topic, putting the question of natural law into a political context once more in the period of the 16th and 17th centuries. And it is a direct consequence of the wars of the Reformation era and the fact that the old Christian commonwealth of the Middle Ages was no more. There was no international forum in which nations could arbitrate their differences, and they were now sovereign states who might see any such forum as an infringement on their own sovereignty. In order to cope with the international problems of the day, you have a school of very important theorists, the most important of whom is Hugo Grotius, who wrote in the early 17th century, trying to develop natural law principles for resolving international problems, which would be based on reason and hence acceptable to everybody, regardless of what theology they adopted as their state religion, and principles that would not interfere with the sovereignty of the individual states. And it was international wars such as the 30 Years' War, which terminated in the Peace of Westphalia in the mid-17th century, that brought this kind of thinking into the fore. You get this interest again in the Enlightenment on the part of cosmopolitans who were trying to break down nationalism and look at mankind as a whole. And I think the same type of thinking cropped up again after World War I, especially the era of good feelings, the League of Nations, the effort to try to create some alternative to war, and to a lesser extent after World War II, I think with perhaps a little more pessimism at that point. But this particular concern for international law and finding ways to get nations to work together harmoniously in the context of modern political life in such a way as to recognize their sovereignty, but to provide principles so that they could negotiate their differences, has caused some interest in the political theory and the natural law element in Stoicism to surface once again.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. My guest was Marcia Kolisch, a scholar at the National Humanities Center and a professor of history at Oberlin College in Ohio. At the center, Professor Kolisch completed a book on Greek Stoicism and its influences, uses, and modifications in subsequent historical periods. The center would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.